Welcome to Jet Streaming. I'm Kathy Werzer. It's just me. Mark and Paul have the week off. You know, after 30 episodes, we here at Jet Streaming thought we'd take a look back at some of the best storm stories we've had on the show. In Oklahoma, the tornado season is a way of life, and TV stations in that state know that comprehensive weather coverage is not only a public service, it can bring in big ratings. Back in May of this year, we talked with Gary Englund of KWTV in Oklahoma City, one of the most recognizable faces in all of Oklahoma. We talked with Gary, who's the chief meteorologist at that station, about one storm in particular, the May 3rd storm of 1999. It brought with it more than 60 tornadoes. We chatted with Gary about that day and his work and a little perk he calls the hot button.
I've heard about the hot button, Gary. Tell us about the hot button. You have the capability to go on the air whenever you need to at an instant, right?
Yeah, we just, but we've learned, you know, years ago we were trying everything, and the one time I was yelling, no, 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 and I was talking to the director, and he punched me up. And he thought I was saying, go, go, go. Now, that was the day we quit using no and go.
Gary, I was part of the NOAA assessment team for the May 3rd event, and I was down in Oklahoma City in with Bridge Creek, and then I was over at Moore. And I got to tell you a little story about a young lady over there, a homeowner. Her house was almost completely demolished, and I had a chance to talk to her. And I said, you weren't home at the time. She says, oh, yeah. And she had heard that the sirens were going off. The sky was black. She was on her way home from the north side of town. And she said, the sirens go off all the time. The sky is black. She says, I got in the house and turned on my message recorder, and I had two messages from my aunt that says, a tornado is coming. They've been showing it forever. It's coming right toward your home.
Wow.
And I said, what'd you do? She says, I turned on the radio and waited to see what Gary Englund was saying about this. And she said that the urgency and the assistance in your voice that said something was coming, she immediately went to the interior portion of the house, a closet, and the house within 30 seconds to a minute disintegrated around her.
Yeah.
So you can take this, that the information provided in a six-hour period was life-saving that day, and despite the destruction, there could have been many more lives lost than an F5 tornado coming through a metropolitan area. So congratulations to you and the Weather Service for a job well done on that day.
Thanks. And that day was a success because, you know, only 44 people were killed. That's 600 to 800 injured. A recent study by the Severe Storms Lab said that if the warnings hadn't been there, we hadn't had the technology and the warnings, they estimated in their study there would have been 600 fatalities. So it was a success. And really, I'd just like to take a second why it was a success. It was because through the years, all the research that was done down at Norman on radars and computer programs, that all came to a head on May 3rd. What everybody had been working toward all the years, and I've been working toward also, it all came together. The warnings from the Weather Service were fantastic. And then we basically just kind of take over because we go, you know, wall to wall, we call it. But it was an incredible day. And, when we look back, we learned so much from that particular day. But the key thing was it was a severe storms lab. It was University of Oklahoma. It was a storm prediction center. All these people had worked all for this day. We knew someday it was going to come. And it came. But the one thing I did that was different, because, you know, everybody's heard the tornado warnings in your part of the world, Minnesota and mine, is tornado warning continues for the Oklahoma City area. Continue with the tornado precautions. Stay with News 9. We'll keep you advised. I've done that 10,000 times, you know, and most of the time a tornado never comes. But in this case, I just said, you need to be below ground level to survive.
Wow.
And I knew I had to get their attention. Because when the helicopter, we were watching it live for an hour and a half. And, you know, it started as a very small tornado system, cycled, and another one. Finally, each time they came back, it got larger and larger and larger. And then near Bridge Creek, the helicopter, I'll never forget this shot, and the helicopter's kind of tilted to the right, and the whole backside of the thunderstorm and the tornado are illuminated, you know, it's all sunshine. And there was this gigantic tornado. It was a mile wide, and it was titanic. And then you see it live going up into the populated areas, and the power lines are just kind of going pow, 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 pow. And you know that people have to be dying because not everyone gets the message. But when I saw it near Chickasha, it was one huge funnel with a satellite tornado rotating around it, and the satellite tornado was about the size of our regular tornadoes. And that's when I finally realized that this was different because no one really thought May 3rd was going to be what it was.
Do you find, Gary, folks in your area, you're in Tornado Alley, do your viewers get jaded? How do you drive your point home?
Well, you know, we have trouble now. It's a long time since May 3rd, and that's really the last time we had anybody really killed. So what's happened, right after May 3rd, everybody loved the warnings. Oh, well, we need to know. Now it's kind of, listen, fool, don't interrupt my program.
Tornado chasers are part of the weather team that helps England get real-time information to the National Weather Service, too. Another daredevil weather watching team is the Air Force Reserve's Hurricane Hunters. Major Deanne and Greg Lufkin, yes, they are married, are part of this elite group. Deanne started off our conversation back in September by telling us how the hunters collect their data.
Well, before, what we used to do is we used to just look down at the water, and what it looked like to us was a wind speed, like hurricanes look like shattered glass on the surface. So we just estimated it based on our eyes. And that was if we could see the water. Now we can figure out what the wind speeds are just by this frequency microwave radiometer. It looks through clouds so we can get a better idea of how strong the winds really are on the surface.
Deanne, Paul Huttner here. When you fly into a hurricane, what is the path that you will take through the storm, and what is flight level? How high off the ocean are you?
Well, in a hurricane, we fly at about 10,000 feet above sea level. In a tropical storm, about 5,000 feet. And when we're investigating a storm, we fly about 1,000 feet off the surface of the water. When we fly in, we fly intercardinal headings, which are northwest, northeast, southwest, southeast. And we do an X pattern, what we call an alpha pattern, through the storm. We do a big X pattern to measure the winds in all four of those quadrants. And we usually go through there at least four times per flight.
Greg Lufkin, is that your job then to decide what path to take?
Well, actually, it's pretty much a crew effort. On the aircraft, I'm a navigator. In civilian life, I'm a pilot with the Continental Airlines, but with the Air Force, I'm a navigator, and Deanne is a meteorologist. She actually runs the show, and she coordinates with the Hurricane Center to determine which quadrant do they want us to enter first. Now, sometimes it makes perfectly good sense. If it's far out in the Atlantic, we're going to enter it from the west side. But sometimes, especially when it's getting close to landfall, the quadrant that's going to hit land first is the quadrant they want to fly us through first. So just to get that data. So my job is to figure out how to get there and get us. We actually start the X pattern Deanne was talking about. It starts about 105 miles from the center, and we try to fly as straight a line as possible to get to the center and fly out another 105 miles. And my job is to keep us clear of islands, stuff that sticks up out of the water that would be bad, and also stronger cells that are in the hurricane. When you look at the satellite picture of a hurricane, it looks sort of homogenous. It's just one big blob. But when you actually get in it and look at it on radar, there's, believe me, a lot of weather there. But some of it's worse than others, and you want to avoid those if you possibly can. And that's my primary job.
Give us an idea about what it is like to fly into a hurricane. What does it feel like? Do you get sick?
Well, you know, some people do. A friend of ours actually was going through Dean, and she spent most of the time doubled over and very unhappy and uncomfortable. There's other people. I've not yet gotten sick in a hurricane, but then I'm used to it.
Wow.
The interesting thing about the hurricanes is I had to fly a few before I really understood why they name them. And that's because they all have their own personalities. They're all different, and they change as they develop and move along. So sometimes some of the worst rides I've had have been in small Category 1 hurricanes, and sometimes some of the smoother rides we've had, now smooth being a relative term, but sometimes some of the smoothest rides are in the Cat 5s.
And usually what it is, it's the growing or decaying storms that are the worst, because then you have your up and your down drafts in the storm, and that's what causes us to have the significantly bumpy rides. Where if you have a storm that's just tooling along at the same wind speed generally, then it's just pretty much swirling around at that same direction, not going up and down a lot. So it's a smoother ride for us. So generally, Cat 5s are pretty nice to fly into.
Unless they make a landfall, and then the interaction of those winds with the land masses can make life very interesting indeed.
What keeps you flying?
Well, a number of things. It's a challenging job. I love aviation and I love weather, and this is the perfect job to combine the two. So it's fun, it's challenging, it's interesting. But the camaraderie of flying with crew members and sharing something in common and doing something that's important, being able to go out and it's You know, it's got its hazard associated with it, but the bonus is we get to actually help people. We can actively save lives and help people protect their property just by going out and doing this, letting the forecasters have the best information possible to determine the most likely track of this so people can do what they need to do, like pack up and get out before it's too late. A lot of people with Katrina, you know, got complacent and thought, well, you know, we haven't had a hurricane hit here in forever. And by the time they decided, you know, this looks bad, we should go, there was no place left to go.
Mm. And Major Dan Lufkin, what keeps you flying?
Well, as a meteorologist, to me, this is the most exciting job ever. You know, when I was 13 and saw the tornado film live here in Minnesota, that's when I knew I wanted to be a meteorologist. And I thought I wanted to chase tornadoes in a Winnebago. But to me, this is just the ultimate weather job. And also knowing that I'm helping to save lives, helping to ensure that people are able to evacuate with plenty of time and let them know how bad the storm really is. It means a lot to me, and that's what keeps me going.
The science of storm prediction has come a long way, as we just heard from Gary Englund and the Hurricane Hunters. But some storms are almost unpredictable. A derecho is a ferocious windstorm. It can leave forecasters with only minutes to warn the public. In July of 1999, Marlon Brie decided to take a cruise on Lake Superior in his ultra-lightweight sailboat. He was on Superior, near the Canadian border, when a derecho roared across the lake coming out of the BWCA, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area of Minnesota. And he remembers it as a pleasant enough day until he peered over his shoulder and saw what he describes as a big monster jumping over the Sawtooth Mountains right at him.
Right after the heavy winds started to hit, I have a little unofficial wind speed gauge on my boat. Call the shrouds, and I've heard various wind speeds in the 20, 30 years or so that I've been sailing on Lake Superior. And here the wind in the rigging started to shriek and then howl and then go off the scale in something that I hadn't heard before. And something like a giant hand sort of gripped the top of the mast and started levering the entire boat down into the water, and at that point the boat bucked, stopped, and did a semi-pitch pole, and I flew forward into the cabin down below. And there were some more shrieks, and I saw water coming up through the centerboard trunk, and I saw my starboard port light turn an interesting shade of green, and that's when I realized that the side of the boat was underwater.
Oh, my goodness. You know, Craig, I did a little research on derechos, and I see they're associated with thunderstorms that are curved in shape, the so-called bow echo on the radar. And I thought bow echoes were indicative of tornadic activity, but are they also fingerprints of derechos?
Bow echoes, or what we call spear echoes, show straight-line wind damage, Kathy, and winds of up to 130 miles an hour. And some of those winds have rotation, particularly near the comma head portion of that that bow echo, and research has been done on that for probably about three decades now that shows that you can have embedded tornado circulation in that. Unfortunately, it's hard to pick out a tornado circulation when you have such devastation with 130-mile-an-hour winds, but if somebody can actually get a good visual on this storm as it's approaching, you might see some actual rotation and some tornado activity with a bow echo or a derecho.
When last we left your story, your light on the, you were underwater pretty much in terms of part of your boat, Marlon. How in the world did you escape dying, really?
Well, for a while I was very concerned that I was going under and would have to start swimming up to the top of my keel. And it was my hope then that I would sit atop the boat and be blown probably out into the middle of Superior, at which time I would start worrying about getting back. But finally, what happened was that after the initial gusts went through, and I just don't know how much microburst energy there was, but it was substantially in excess of 100 miles an hour, I guess. The winds went ratcheted down somewhat to maybe 60 or 80 miles an hour. And I had hurt myself going into the cabin because I was simply thrown in there because the boat bow dug in under speed, and I was thrown forward, much like a bully on a teeter-totter tosses the lesser occupant. I picked myself out, went out to the cabin, went out to the cockpit, and just in time to see three heavy fenders, rubber fenders, that I had laid out for my arrival in Thompson Cove, go one by one up into the sky for some reason. And finally, what happened was that as the boat bucked around, the engine was out of the water, the rudder was out of the water, and as it went over, I simply tossed myself over the side enough to put my weight on the side of the boat. Since this is an ultra-lightweight centerboard 20-foot boat, I had some effect. When the wind finally went down, the boat simply plopped back down in the water. The mast came back up, and the spetters at times were touching the water. And I could head off successfully, and I simply turned it around, turned the outboard up to full throttle, and headed for the nearest pile of rocks that I could find, at which point I simply rode out much of the storm behind the rocks, keeping my speed up, and I was in the cockpit. Incidentally, it's a couple of things about this wind. It's a downward wind that's pressing on you. It is very violent during the open phase, and it's also very cold. Now, for that 4th of July day on Superior, I was wearing long johns, winter fleece, and a boater's jacket with fleece on the inside, and I was in some state of hyperthermia. I was shivering so badly.
Wow.
My goodness. What did that wind burst do to wave heights on the lake? Did they go up substantially?
No, actually, everyone asked me that, and I said, you must be in terrible waves and all of that sort of thing. And actually, the downburst came and it smashed the water flat. And when I first emerged from the cockpit there after the pitch pull, I looked out, and there were simply long furrows of spume, thousands of feet long and maybe 20 to 30 feet in diameter, writhing like snakes on the water all around me.
Well, after all that talk about intense storms, it's nice to be reminded about how gentle the sky can be. Did you know there are more than 80,000 members of the Cloud Appreciation Society? And they love all manner of cloud formations. And there are many of them. Back in May, we talked with Gavin Pretor-Pinney. He's the founder of the Cloud Appreciation Society. And we caught up with him at his London home. How did you first find yourself gazing upward and contemplating the clouds?
Well, it was when I was a kid, so there was nothing special about that. It's something that kids do, isn't it? And when I was, I don't know, I suppose 4, 5, 6, around that age, I first became interested in clouds. I remember looking up and seeing one with the rays of sunlight that you sometimes see behind, breaking out from behind a cloud. I now know they're called crepuscular rays. But at the time, I just thought, what is that thing up there? And these rays made me, I guess, attracted my attention. And I thought, what is it? What's it made of? Why is it there? And what would it be like to sit on it?
Why do you think clouds hold such a fascination for humans?
Well, I think they are, there's something contradictory about them. They're both objects, and yet you can't touch them. They have no, they're bodies without surface. That's what Leonardo da Vinci called them. And so there's something intriguing about clouds. But then the other thing is that the way they change, they're in constant flux, this ephemeral nature of them where they're never the same for two moments. This seems to give them an emotive quality. So they're scientific phenomena which can be explained in terms of the basic principles of science, yet they seem to have something very emotional about them. They're like, they blow over like emotions do. And so I think for all these reasons, they're rather intriguing. And then, of course, you know, we all love a sunset, and a sunset, the beauty of a sunset comes from the clouds.
Gavin, this is Mark Seeley. I just wanted to pay you a compliment. I think your Cloud Spotter's Guide is one of the best books I've read in recent years.
Oh, that's so kind of you. Thank you very much.
It's very, very engaging, and I find it easy to get caught up in your narrative. I actually got it over, my wife got it for me when we were over in your country last October, so I have the UK version of your book.
Right.
But what I was fascinated with also was the Cloud Appreciation Society, if I'm not mistaken, is now over 8,000 members. Is that right?
That's right. It's been a surprise to me almost how much it's grown. I think it's really a society of the internet age, in that the great thing about clouds is that they have no interest and they don't respect political boundaries or geographic boundaries, and so the fact that the internet is this tool for uniting people who have an interest in clouds is really one reason why it's grown in a kind of organic way. It seems to have grown like, you know, the way that things grow virally on the internet. People tell their friends, they email other people. And so, yes, we've got over 8,000 members in, I think it's 44 countries now.
On the Cloud Appreciation website, there are hundreds of photos of beautiful clouds. That website, by the way, is www.cloudappreciationsociety.org. If you're a weather geek, and you likely are, given that you are listening to this, you probably have a favorite cloud formation. I asked Gavin about his favorite cloud, and he describes it quite passionately.
Well, I'm rather partial to lenticular clouds, which, as you probably know, are the ones that form typically in hilly or mountainous regions. And when the atmosphere's a certain way, the air streams that reach a mountain and have to rise to pass over it can have a wavy route in the lee of the mountain. They kind of go up and down in wave-like formations. And at the crest of each of these waves, you sometimes get a cloud forming, which is a very dramatic and beautiful type of cloud, the lenticular cloud. The official name for the Latin lovers would be altocumulus lenticularis. But if you're a glider pilot, you might just call them Lennies. And the great thing about them is that they look like UFOs or flying saucers.
These lenticular clouds also sometimes take on very unusual shapes, shapes that we can construe as depicting an image of an object or something. And I couldn't help but notice, Gavin, that on, I think it's the Cloud Chat section of your website, that it's proposed that you and your colleague Ian Loxley are going to do a second book, and you're going to collect photos of cloud forms that depict certain images or things like that. Are you well underway on that topic?
It's all pretty much done. I've just about sent it off to the printers. It's something that we've encouraged people to do, is to send in photographs of clouds that look like things, because it's, you know, with all this science is all well and good, but one of the pleasures of cloud spotting and sitting and watching the clouds is to let one's imagination drift along with them and to see to see what shapes appear to you. So I really felt that perhaps that was something that we hadn't really explored enough in the first book, and so this second book is going to be coming out in time for Christmas, and it's a collection of our favorites of the photographs of clouds that look like things that members have sent in. And there's just some brilliant ones in there. There's, you know, there is a UFO one, like one of these lenticular clouds. There's a great one of a dog's head from Australia. There's what was the best one? Possibly Salvador Dali. Profile of Salvador Dali, even his curling moustache is visible.
Wow. Well, now, does this second book have a title yet?
Well, the title of the UK edition is going to be A Pig with Six Legs and Other Clouds from the Cloud Appreciation Society.
You should know that A Pig with Six Legs and Other Clouds is in print, and the US version is called
hot pink flying saucers and other clouds. You can find them both at the Cloud Appreciation Society website. And that, friends, is going to do it for this week. We will be back next week talking about one of the all-time big blizzards in the Midwest, the Halloween Blizzard of 1991. I'm Kathy Werzer. Until then, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.